And there it is, Brisbane's Riverside Expressway. A glorious relic of that moment in Australian cities when the best use of riverside real estate seemed to be the construction of a freeway. And yes, here we are, right on the northern shore of the Brisbane River. River cats plying their way alongside six lanes of traffic. That looks, well, from here, like a road, a little bit unprepossessing, but perhaps with the benefit of a view from on high, we may see it in a different light. I'm Jonathan Green. You're listening to Lost and Found. It's a Blueprint for Living production. As you may have guessed, I have landed, yes, in Brisbane. It's part of our search for modern Australia's architectural gems. Soon we'll be back on the Riverside Expressway with architectural historian Don Watson in tow. And later, we'll get along to see World War II igloos at Archerfield Airport. Sounds odd? Well, we will explain. But first, to the authors of Australia Modern, Architecture, Landscape and Design, 1925-1975, Hannah Louie and Philip Goad. Philip, as we enter Brisbane, this city stretched along that Serpentine River, where do we find the modern?
In the 1930s, you would find in Brisbane little moments of modernism, mainly in houses by people like Charles Fulton and Robert Cummings. But really, it's war that transforms Brisbane. Mm. You know, this is where MacArthur starts the move seriously north towards New Guinea. And World War II is essentially fought from Brisbane. And I think the buildings which really epitomise that are often pragmatic buildings built for wartime. And in particular, in Australia Modern, Don Watson's written a really fantastic entry on these what we call igloo hangars. And these are light timber trussed arched aircraft hangars. And they're really sort of the infrastructure of modernism. At the other level, you have an emigre like Karl Langer, a Viennese-trained, highly sophisticated architect who ends up in Brisbane with his wife Gertrude, who becomes the art critic for the Brisbane Courier Mail. And Karl Langer, I think, has an important influence not only in education, some houses, but also he's the architect of West's Furniture, where the public could buy great mid-century furniture in the 50s.
It's an extraordinary. I mean, we underestimate that moment, Hannah, in Brisbane's history, and it's this influx of people. It becomes a jazz town, a place of tremendous nightlife, and a centre of activity. Apart from being locked in war, and as Philip suggests, this is a renaissance for that place.
Yeah, and a place of leisure that suits its climate. So one of my favourite buildings, and I have a bit of a thing about pools, is the Centenary Pool in the 50s by James Birrell. And this Queensland pool's really quite different to other pools around the country, and it's got a bit of glamour, you know, a bit of exoticness. It's got a sort of organic shapes. You could sit in the restaurant originally on the second floor and look down on this exquisitely tiled pool and believe that you were in South America.
Have you swum in that pool?
Yes.
So looking for a higher view, come to the 21st floor of the Park Regis Hotel, which is perched above that freeway, which is where I find Don Watson. Don, hello.
Good morning, Jonathan.
From the University of Queensland, and something of a fan of this freeway.
I am a fan of this freeway, and I was just telling Jonathan it was originally provoked by a crazy scheme to totally cover it up, to hide the disgraceful appearance of it.
What was here before that was constructed?
Well, that was a point I made at the time, that they used to argue it was the front door of Brisbane, but in fact you could show quite easily it was the back door. It was the site of a sanitary depot with barges collecting all the night soil for depositing in Moreton Bay, and the morgue regularly had premises right along this reach of the river. So, an industrial sort of area.
Well, this goes back. What period are we talking about here?
The construction's in the 1970s, but the transportation plan that provoked it is 1965.
And that goes back to a moment in our... Well, certainly in the case of Brisbane and Melbourne as river cities, where the river was a very utilitarian and a pretty ugly space.
That's right, it was utilitarian, and as one of my colleagues at the university said at the time, he wrote an article about it, and he said the premiers mistook the river for a vacant lot. and that was how it was being treated, and I might say we still treat parks like that. They're all just development opportunities.
Now, you're impressed by this as a piece of engineering.
Yes, it's a great piece of engineering, and from the 1930s, where they were trying to create employment, capital works in Queensland was well organised under the Coordinator General, and they had sort of 5-year plans to predict how they should spend the money and the like. But they also had very close relationships with the university, and the students trained there, and students went overseas and did postgraduate training. And they were really a brilliant group of engineers that worked for the Coordinator General in the Main Roads Department after the war.
So this motorway stretches from where to where?
Well, the distance we're looking at here is 2 kilometres of it, and it stretches from what was originally the Grey Street Bridge, now the William Jolly Bridge at the northern end, through to the Captain Cook Bridge, crossing over to Woolloongabba at the south, and that joins on to the South Eastern Freeway or the Pacific Motorway that goes through to the Gold Coast.
So it's clearly a good direct route skirting that narrow wedge of the CBD here.
Yes, the CBD in Brisbane is on a very narrow peninsula of the river, so it's very confined. 3 sides are disrupted, if you like, or blocked by the river, and then the other side is quite steep hillsides. And the river is wide, relatively, and so that the cost of building bridges was high. And until the 1930s, the only bridge in Brisbane was the Victoria Bridge, which is halfway down this town reach of the river. And they just couldn't afford to build another one at that time. There were plans at various times for others, but and what resulted from that is a lot of congestion occurred at both abutments of the Victoria Bridge, as it was called, but also in the northeastern section of the city at Petrie Bide.
So this gives a very elegant bypass of the CBD.
Yeah, well, it does do that, and it provides excellent access. It's worked in a terrific way for 50 years. Because it had repercussions that went way beyond just the construction of the freeway itself. It led to the one-way making roads in the CBD and couplets one-way, and that also then organised the off and on-ramps onto the freeway in a simpler way. I mean, some people now hate that and think that all roads should be pedestrianised, but you can see by the amount of traffic here now, 11 o'clock in the morning, it's not peak hour and it's still pretty busy.
Well, it is. It's carrying a good volume, and as you say, here we are in the midst of a school holiday, mid-morning.
Yeah.
The traffic, it's skirting around, following the river, snaking along that brown path of the Brisbane River. It's doing its job.
Well, the two bridges we can see here, the Victoria and it's the third or fourth Victoria Bridge on that side, and the Captain Cook Bridge, are both concrete box girder bridges. And at this time, Queensland was at the forefront of these bridges on a world scale. And they kept doing other bridges, and some of them were on foot in other parts of the freeway that people might like even less than this, through New Farm and the like. But each of the bridges they did had a larger span, the planned span. And eventually the Gateway Bridge, which was the most furthest downstream, it was 260 metre span, and that was the largest span in the world for more than a decade when it was opened in 1985. But they were at the forefront of that sort of work.
So this 70s motorway, I guess the constricting thing about its location is that it's very hard to, as is the habit with the freeways these days, to expand its width. You're pretty much stuck with what's there.
Yeah, it would be very difficult to make it wider. But, I mean, it has worked extraordinarily well. And even they did give lots of thought to the queuing distances and acceleration lanes and things coming onto it. And I'd say it's worked in brilliantly, except for one brief period where someone who was ignorant about how the structure actually worked suddenly decided that it was possibly failing, and he closed the whole system down for a few days, and the city was in complete gridlock.
The sixth part of the roadway was sort of flexing in the heat.
Yes, so the geometry of it is all fantastic and highly standardised, so that the roadway are all in sections of 110 feet, I'll use feet if you don't mind, all the ramps are curved to the same radius, and the depth of all the headstocks at the tops of the piles are all concealed within the depth of the road, so it's very neat and tidy and minimised any intrusion to views at that level across the river. It's all extremely elegant, the engineering, and done with a great deal of care, including with an architectural consultant, Stuart McIntosh, who was a very good architect from Melbourne, who had the misfortune to win the Great Hall competition at the University of Queensland. And then the job came in over budget, and he had to relocate as part of the competition conditions. And that was a great shame for his career, really. He was very good.
What else strikes you about it as a piece of design and or engineering?
Well, one of the things they took great care with are just the pile caps. Underneath all of the bearing sections of the bridges and the freeway are multiple piles down into the riverbed. And then they have to be all tied together with a pile cap. And for all the freeway work, all the pile caps were kept below the low water mark so that it would minimise the opportunities for debris catching on it. And you only have to look at some of the more recent bridges to see that the pile caps are all way above low tide level and are quite massive often. They're like islands in the river. And the same about the top. So very neat integrating the headstocks into the road deck level. It was just a consistent depth along its entire length of 5 feet, but very elegant.
And a great survivor, a road that's needed very little work in its long life.
Well, they've spent nothing to speak of on it. It hasn't even been repainted in 50 years. It was quite very nicely painted with a kind of pale green sort of colour on the soffits of the road deck. I think that was probably the choice of Stuart McIntosh. But going back to what I like about it, it goes back a bit to Rainer Bannon, the architectural historian who used to talk about the Santa Monica and San Diego intersection in the freeway there, saying it was one of the greater works of man. And I think this is highly sculptural. I think this is a better bit of public art than almost any public art we've got in recent years. But Peter Cook, the Archigram guy from London, was out here as a visiting professor, and he was a great fan of it and did an exhibition of paintings that were all derived from it and the bridges.
It's hard for us to see something which is, you know, so functional in that light often.
It is terribly hard, and I'm still mystified by it, by somehow freeways, by definition, are ugly. You know, and also they're abhorrent, that we should be all better not using them, but it's pretty hard not to use them in Brisbane. And I mean, I use public transport all the time. But gee, even to go and do the supermarket shopping, I take the car.
As you say, the elegance of its curves, the way in which that just falls against the river and you know, so sort of gracefully to the eye as well.
Yeah, well, I did think even about the rising tide level, the base of all the piers that are all circular, again, to minimise catching debris, but they're all painted black, and that covers the varying tidal range. And, I mean, they gave it a lot of thought. They also, I must say, gave thought to what happened underneath, and that was landscaped for the first time since European settlement almost. And they had things that I find slightly bizarre now, a sculpture court and things like that. And I mean, it's not an ideal place to... It's the southwestern bank of the CBD, so it's a high bank too, so that the whole space underneath it is in shadow until after lunch, and it's exposed to winter winds here in the winter, so it's cold. It's not an ideal hospitality space, but we're about to get acres of it under the new casino, and they're going to cover some of this in. But it's not a good place in a way to be. It's not a climatically comfortable place, quite for getting the fumes and things.
But our rivers, increasingly are very human spaces and a real priority for creating that sort of recreational verge.
Well, that's right, and that's what's happened on the other bank, the South Bank side, which is the remnant site of Expo 88 in Brisbane, is substantially a park. I mean, I would have liked it to be entirely a park. I never understood the economics. Somehow they did a whole lot of commercial development because I don't think they got the money back anyway. But it could have been a very big park, and as it is, it's still a good park.
You're listening to Lost and Found on Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green. We are in Brisbane with architectural historian Don Watson, finishing up at the Riverside Expressway and then landing at the Archerfield Second World War Igloo Complex. Don, we've come out to Archerfield Airfield on the fringe of Brisbane. This, well, it's called an igloo in sort of the vernacular, but not really.
No, I did briefly look that up yesterday to try and see why they were called igloos. I think it's a vault, not a dome, but I think the general vaulted shape might have reasonably recalled an igloo, but there's no direct connection as far as I can see. But it was called igloo from very early on.
So Hastings Deering, a heavy machinery and engineering business here now, but back in World War II, these buildings had a very different use.
Oh, well, no, they were still in industrial use. I mean, the building's been used for industry its whole life, and but originally during the war it was used for maintenance of airplane components.
The extraordinary thing here is the wooden structure that holds this great span of this curving roof.
Yeah. It's an absolutely amazing structure, and that it's among the largest timber span structures still in Australia. But this building was built in 1942, at the end of 1942, and it was one of a whole lot of these igloos that were built. They were the most successful large span structures in the South Pacific, at least, in the Second World War. And they were built in very large numbers, although the numbers that survive is only quite a small number. But they were built by the hundreds during the war. And they have a great story. They are based originally on an idea for, they were called hideouts for protecting planes on the ground. And planes are more vulnerable when they're on the ground than they are when they're flying. Even if there's someone chasing you up in the air, your chances of being wiped out if you're static on the ground are very great.
So the space here is like a big aircraft hangar. So
yeah, that's right. So they made these so-called, these things were originally designed to be hideouts without the roof structure like this, the same timber structure but without the cladding, and they're covered with camouflage nets and then saplings and things of that kind.
Oh, so no roof as such, just the sort of the camouflage
just
cover.
Just the structure and the camouflage put on top.
Just describe that wooden formwork here.
Well, the wooden formwork are sort of box trusses, timber trusses, and it's a three-pinned arch structure, a pin on each at ground level on each side, plus one in the centre, and they're prefabricated on the ground in a jig. You could make them quite quickly and things, and then they're erected with a similar king post sort of strut and a winch that pulled the two elements up together and then pinned them at the centre. But they're made out of extraordinarily light hardwood. Most of the structures, their webbing in the box girders is only 3 by 1 inch. They're tiny, 75 by 25 millimetres. The actual frame element is a bit larger than that, but still only 2 out of 2 inch timber. It's very light. It's absolutely extraordinary.
But there's a lot of it.
Yeah, there is a lot of it. That's right. When you see how many of these buildings were built, plus all the warehouses as well in the Second World War, it's remarkable there were any trees left in Queensland.
So who's responsible for that design work on that trussing?
Yeah, well, the story of the design is a great story, and it really relates to concrete, reinforced concrete structures rather than timber. And the designer of them is a French engineer called Emile Brizet. And he served in the First World War, then trained as an engineer after the war, then worked for a very famous engineer called Eugène Freyssinet, who was a pioneer of reinforced concrete construction. And he worked on some hangars at Villa Coublay in France. This is Brizet working for Freyssinet. And then after that, he went out to a French colonial company in the Far East and worked for them for a while, and then went into practice in Singapore as an engineer. Then when the war was declared...
Right place, wrong time.
Well, he was there for a long time, and there's a lot to show. I might say among the buildings he built in Singapore were the Ford Company's plant, which was the Japanese headquarters for the war, a very good building that survives. But when the Japanese invaded Malaya the day after Pearl Harbor, the British military authorities contacted Brizet and said, we need to have a design for these hideouts to protect planes on the ground. And overnight, Brizet came up with this idea of these timber structures. And what I realised when I started researching it is that there was a good chance that the structure would have been the formwork for Freyssinet's original reinforced concrete igloo in France. And that turned out to be right. I've got pictures of the construction of those, and the structure is very similar.
So this is formwork for what originally would have been concrete spans.
Yeah, having a concrete, yes. And then you got rid of all the formwork and were left with the concrete. But anyway, the Japanese invasion went so quickly in Malaysia, there wasn't time to do it. He was commissioned to do 150 of them, but he had to get out. His family were evacuated to Melbourne, and then he escaped from Singapore just before Singapore fell, went overland in Java and caught a ship out of there just before that fell. But in Melbourne, he had good contacts because of the Hume Pipe Company that had a factory next to the Ford factory in Singapore. So he had good industrial connections in Australia. But the other thing to remember about the war is in the first 6 months of the war, the architectural and engineers to the whole American forces was a private company called Sevadup and Parcel, who were originally commissioned to do some airports in the South Pacific to provide a safer route to the Philippines. And when that was abandoned, when the Japanese started attacking, they came to Australia and were given the job to provide architectural and engineering services for the American Army. And that persisted until May 1942. But in that first half of 1942, after Brisset arrives from Singapore, he gets in touch with his engineering mates in Melbourne, who put him in touch with Manuel Hornibrook in Brisbane, who's another big civil engineering contractor, and they're commissioned to start doing structures. And so they first of all do igloos as hideouts in the Malaysian idea, but quickly realise that if you put purlins on it, the secondary structure, and then sheeted the roof, you've got a fantastically useful storage or workshop.
Well, and here we are, all those years later, still within and this interior space. Yeah. It's remarkable. I mean, the span of it. Do you know the statistics?
The span here is 188 foot 6 inches. And which is curiously very similar to the original Villa Kublai Fraser-Ney building, but they built these in a number of different sizes. 140 feet was another span, and 170 feet was another one that they used often.
It's an infinitely adaptable design. And the floor area?
The principal. Well, the building, I don't know the area, but the building, it's 353 feet long by 188 feet wide. So it's
big.
A large building. But there was no reason why it couldn't be extended by bays. In longitudinally, as much as you
longitudinally, do. It's infinitely expandable.
That's right. Yes, but curiously, during the war, someone said that if they last 2 years, you've used too much material, and as you say, they're still here now. And
you could almost say that those spans are a tad over-engineered.
Well, I don't know that they're over-engineered, but they've certainly put up with anything that they've struck in they've 70 years.
Stood a significant test of time.
And, I mean, the ones that were demolished might have been for a whole range of other reasons and not the structural failure. I mean, White Ants was a potential kind of risk, but it is hardwood. It's reasonably durable. And they have concrete abutments on the ground that separates. And as long as someone keeps an idea, they're pretty safe from White Ants. The timber here seems to be painted, but that wouldn't have happened during the war. So I don't know when...
I just had an impression of the worst possible job, which would be painting that timber.
Yes, I know. That's right. That's what is a surprise to me. But it does look like it's been painted.
Because it's such an intricate lacework, and it's a repeated pattern. I guess every sort of dozen or so meters, we have another span of this great boxing of the slim timbers. It's such a beautiful repeated pattern.
Yes, it. And it was very economical, which is partly why it was so popular. But they had it costed down to man-hours. Like, to build one of these was something like 2,900 man-hours from scratch. And the cost was 1 11 pence a square foot was the cost of the structure at the time. So they had it down. And they could quantify how quickly a new team, who hadn't built one before, they took 30% longer time to build. But they quickly got into the pattern of doing it, and it became very efficient and fast.
Oh, and here they are. Don, thank you. And thank you for your command of the relevant figures.
Okay, yes. No, well, it's a pleasure. I'm very fond of it. And certainly Emile Brisset's story, it was a terrific story. But it's interesting the way ideas are transferred, like it's Dusenet's formwork, but then used in a quite different context and proved very useful. This is the whole basis of industrialisation in Brisbane after the war. The wartime structures were all used for, 10, 20, 40, 50 years.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production looking in search of Australian modern, this week in Brisbane Thanks to Hannah Louie, Philip Goad and Don Watson. Next week we are off to Hobart. Producers are Lisa Divisi, Rosa Ellen and Verica Jokic. Technical production by Carey Dell. I'm Jonathan Green.